Stop badgering me with your $10 words.
7 years of college down the drain.
I figured out what to do with our sinner children.
There's no crying in baseball!
Boy, this sounds like more trouble than a moose on the interstate.
From his reserved seats high above the evangelical circus, this is a voice of sanity in search of a Jesus-shaped Christianity, sending dispatches from the post-evangelical wilderness to whomever is on the same journey. You are now part of Internet Monk Radio with your host, the Internet Monk, Michael Spencer.
I whisper things into your head and you hear the words, but you don't believe me.
Well, hello, everyone. Welcome to Internet Monk Radio, podcast number 104. I am your genial host, Michael Spencer. Welcome to my world. For a few moments this morning, it is a rainy Wednesday morning here in southeastern Kentucky, and a noisy Wednesday morning right down the street from my house. The ministry that I work for is doing a lot of work on a road, and there is every kind of large truck and construction vehicle, so it may sound like I am somewhere in the middle of a construction zone, and you will be exactly right. Well, I'm very glad to have you with me today. As I look at the numbers each week of people who download this podcast, I just absolutely get giddy that there is a podcast audience of almost 2,000 people every week for Internet Monk Radio. Thank you. Maybe you're just enamored with my Kentucky accent, and that's what most of you are doing, just listening in amazement to how we talk out here. But if some of you are hanging in there for the content, I salute you. Well, I want to talk a little bit about some stuff that I've been doing in the last few days. One thing that I've been doing is catching up on some of the podcasts that I missed while I was on sabbatical. And I want to plug a podcast that has rapidly become one of my favorites. It is called Speaking of Faith. And many of you probably know about it. It is a, American Public Media, maybe. It's not public radio. I think it's American Public Media. Speaking of Faith, Krista Tippett is the host, and she basically just does a about an hour-long podcast documentary on some subject having to do with religion. So it touches a lot on Christianity, but a few weeks ago, it was dealing with paganism in England. The one I'm listening to right now is on traditional religion in China. This is award-winning quality stuff on every level. The website has a lot of resources that aren't in the podcast. For example, if she does an interview with someone, it's an edited interview in the podcast, but the extended interview is always available at the website. It really is an education, and I believe that most of the audience for Internet Monk Radio and InternetMonk.com would really enjoy it. So if you're not listening to this, check it out. Speaking of Faith with Krista Tippett, and let me know what you think. Another thing that I've been doing is I've been listening to a lot of sermons by Greg Boyd. Need a sound effect right there of people picking up stones. I don't know what that sounds like. But yes, that Greg Boyd. I've got to tell you. And I'm probably motivated a number of ways by to listen to Pastor Boyd. I see a lot of things that he says, and I think that's exactly right. But Pastor Boyd has a reputation for believing some things that are unorthodox, and he's identified with the open theology thing. And so I'm sure that there are plenty of listeners out there that say, There he goes. There he goes. Off sailing into the seas of heresy. But Boyd is the pastor of, I believe it's called Woodlawn Community Church. Hope that's right. He's not teaching anymore. He's pastoring and writing. He's a very interesting guy. He's a guy who was saved in a Pentecostal charismatic environment, but then his questions from his atheist background pushed him all the way down the road to Yale and Princeton and a PhD in teaching in New Testament. And he writes these world-class books on Jesus, which is how I got really interested in his writing. I read quite a bit of his writing on warfare theodicy back in the day, but I've been reading more of his stuff on Jesus the last few years. And yet when you hear him preach, he's just extremely popular level, and brings all of this, brings the charismatic background, sort of third wave style. He brings the scholarly stuff. He brings the pastoral application. And when I think about making pastoral application of Christianity, I'm really thinking about, okay, how does the rubber meet the road with all this for what you believe? What do you have to say to hurting people? What do you have to say to people for whom life is careening out of control? And Pastor Boyd, in my view, really hits the note right. No matter what theology he's coming from, the way he handles pastoral issues, whether they're very painful ones or mundane ones, has really resonated with me and helped me greatly. And I haven't enjoyed this kind of preaching in a very long time. And I have found it to be very helpful. So I'll try to remember to put a link to the archive. He puts every kind of resource up there with his sermons, PowerPoint and printed materials, and he's got all kinds of seminars, and it's good stuff. Also, this past week, my daughter and son and son-in-law threw in some money to get my wife and I 30th anniversary present. They gave us tickets to go see Alison Krauss and Robert Plant. Now, if you don't know who those two people are, let me explain. Robert Plant is the former lead singer of a little band called Led Zeppelin, arguably the best set of pipes in rock and roll. And they're still there. He's gotten a little older. And, of course, Led Zeppelin hasn't been active for a long time. But the man can still wail. But he's got a tremendous vocal range, and he has a real appreciation for the roots music that lays behind rock and roll. And then Alison Krauss is just the premier vocalist and arranger, musician in the modern revival of bluegrass. I really think about Tony Rice and David Grisman, and then the next wave of people, really starting with Alison Krauss, and then a lot of people beyond that, down to Nickel Creek. That sort of sound. Alison Krauss is the voice of an angel. Very, very soothing, beautiful voice. But I found out she can wail too. And this was 2 hours of just this album they've put out together, which is very subdued, traditional roots music. And then they covered a lot of Zeppelin stuff, and they're covering it with banjos and acoustic instruments. And then Alison is singing Tom Waits, and wow, what a tremendously eclectic show. And it was the next to last show, so you're not going to catch it out there anymore, but we had great seats down on the floor, and the concert was amazing. And the album is just full of stuff that comes from my Appalachian environment here, and it was a lot of fun to hear Robert Plant, Alison Krauss singing these traditional mountain songs. And then right around the corner, they're doing Black Dog with banjos covering the lead lines. A wonderful evening with Alison Krauss and Robert Plant. What was almost as entertaining was a guy about 5 or 6 rows in front of us. Those of you that go to concerts, and I used to go a lot, I don't go much anymore. Those of you that go to concerts know that people around you can be very irritating, or they can be very entertaining. Because they were serving alcohol at Rupp Arena, it was very entertaining and got more entertaining the longer evening went on. The music, which was provided by T-Bone Burnett and Buddy Miller and a band they had put together, the music was sometimes music with a danceable beat, but lots of times it was not. It was music that was very laid back, very acoustic, very mountain bluegrass. But that didn't stop the lady in front of me from trying to dance on everything. Just one of those people who, I'm going to dance on funeral dirges because that's what I came here to do. And the more I'm drinking, the more I'm dancing. So there were certain places of the show where everyone in the stadium is sitting down, except the lady right in front of us who's just dancing away with doing all these dance moves from the 1960s. And then about five rows in front of me is a guy. And if this is a family podcast and there are children nearby, I'm going to try to put this delicately. This is a guy who appeared to have invested quite a bit of money. We're talking about $65 a seat here. Who had invested money on a date with two women who seemed to be hoping that his date with two women would continue after the concert, if you know what I mean. And this was not working out because the two women were increasingly enjoying one another's company and increasingly not really noticing he was there. And by the end of the evening, as the two ladies are dancing together and whatnot, and quite a bit of whatnot, and this gentleman is trying to kind of insert himself into the activities. I really wish I had a video camera. It was somebody who had invested a lot of money in a dream, and his dream was slipping away. I think he was about to become the driver for their date. The world. Finally, let me tell you that if you would like to be bizarrely entertained, somebody on the Boar's Head Tavern found a guy on YouTube who makes Todd Bentley, if you don't know who Todd Bentley is, you have to go check that out yourself, who makes Todd Bentley look as sober as a judge. His name is John Crowder, C-R-O-W-D-E-R, and his thing is that he's drunk in the spirit all the time, and he does all of these things trying to equate the Holy Spirit with getting high on drugs and alcohol, particularly marijuana. Is a video of he and his friend smoking weed in a car, getting high, and the whole thing is supposed to be we're getting high on the Holy Spirit. You look at this, and you really do need to look at it, and you say to yourself, this is Gnosticism that's more Gnostic than first century Gnosticism, and that has less to do with Christianity than first century Gnosticism. And yet here it is in a church, adult Christians glibly grinning and saying, wow, God is here. Do people have any idea what it would be like if God and his presence, his power and spirit showed up in a room? Do you really think that people would begin acting as if they were high on drugs? Do you have anything in Scripture, aside from this story in Acts, in which there's one line about, oh, they're drunk? Is there anything else? And, of course, I know these people, they go back in the Old Testament, they say, oh, look, you'll be overwhelmed with joy. You'll be overcome with happiness. So that means you'll be higher than a kite. Amazing thinking. The greatest appeal, my friends, of the Roman Catholic Church is what happens when you give your average, ignorant person a Bible and just say, take off, and let's see what you come up with. John Crowder makes Todd Bentley look like a judge. Well, I'll be right back in just a moment, and we will talk a little bit about Rick Warren. Well, why am I going to talk about Rick Warren? Well, we're going to talk about Rick Warren and evangelicalism. Be right back. ¶¶ Okay, just to remind you, on the third segment of the podcast today, I'm going to be finishing up the brief overview of my first Cornerstone seminar, which was on Dispatches from the Evangelical Wilderness. And that is one of two seminars I did at Cornerstone 08. And I've already done the first two parts of that seminar in the previous two podcasts, just an overview of the things that I talked about there. I talked about my own journey into the evangelical wilderness, and I talked about the critiques of evangelicalism that speak to me while I'm out there. You're now about to hear it rain really hard for a few minutes. And now I'm going to deal with some of my responses and some of what I think I've learned of what we can do out here in the evangelical wilderness. By the way, that metaphor, the evangelical wilderness, obviously describes where a lot of people are. The mail that I get of the stories of people who have passed through all the different kinds of churches that we collect and are just nowhere. And I got to tell you, I'm with you. I was in a church this Sunday, and I felt like I was part of the people of God, and I felt like I was part of the body of Christ, but that sense of homelessness in the evangelical wilderness, it remains. Well, I wanted to talk just a minute about a story that's been in the news, and that is that the two presidential candidates, John McCain and Barack Obama, appear at a conference at Saddleback Community Church, Saddleback Valley Community Church in California, and they're both going to be interviewed by Rick Warren. And they have both agreed that Rick Warren will be the one to ask both of them all of the questions that are going to be asked. And the news media is going on and on about, well, this is the big play for the evangelical vote, to put Barack Obama and John McCain in front of Rick Warren and let him ask 30 minutes each solo questions, and then I guess he's going to ask them together some questions. And that this is going to be this big play for the votes of evangelicals. Let me tell you what comes to my mind, and I have said that I've been way too critical of Rick Warren in the past, and I have publicly, in print, repented of that and said that Rick Warren is a good guy, and I greatly admire what he's done with his success and greatly admire the way he is seeking to live out a Jesus-shaped Christianity in the public arena. And he's a good man, and he's devoted to Christ, and he's devoted to the gospel. I'm not giving him real high marks for his articulation of the gospel in public, but I've learned over my many years as a Christian that a lot of people don't articulate the gospel really well when they get in public. I know you can all say, well, Al Mohler does and John MacArthur does, and that's true. But Tony Campolo does too, for those of you that think it's just a conservative thing. No, it's more difficult than I think we think, and Rick's coming along, but he's... The public venues that I saw when he first became a major public figure, he didn't do a very good job articulating the gospel. But here's what I'm thinking is that Rick Warren does not represent how evangelicals feel about politics. He represents how the big media feel about evangelicals. Now, you're immediately going to say, well, Rick Warren represents the 25 gazillion people who bought the purpose-driven life. Well, first of all, the story of the publishing phenomena that is the purpose-driven life is not the story of every little evangelical making their way to the bookstore and saying, I want that book. I hope you know that. This was a book that was pre-sold by the hundreds of thousands and bought by churches by the thousands, it's a publication phenomenon. I mean, obviously a lot of evangelicals bought it. But I know very, very, very few evangelicals who would say that Rick Warren represents them as evangelicals. Now, he does represent, I think, some of that evangelical core, you know, personal commitment to Christ. The Bible is my authority. Concern for evangelism. Concern for living it out in the real world. In terms of typical evangelicalism, yes, Rick Warren is somebody that kind of, you know, has something in common with all of us. But specific evangelicals, saying that Rick Warren has been representative of the evangelicalism that I relate to, you're talking there about a very particular demographic. It's white, it's suburban, it's mega churchish. It's the soccer mom demographic. And I just want to say to the mainstream media, you're going to have to wake up sooner or later that evangelicalism in all its diversity cannot be nailed down by, well, who does Rick Warren seem to like? You know, every evangelical from African American evangelicals to the Shane Claiborne crowd to, people who are still in the main lines and are interested in political and social justice issues for a very long time, folks like Tony Campolo and I mean, every kind of evangelical, the Passion Movement, Gigolo, and those people, the resurgence of Calvinism, the theological Calvinists, each of these groups really thinks for themselves, and they don't look at a guy like Billy Graham or Rick Warren and say, well, what direction are they going to point us? That's the direction that we'll go. And I'm not saying it's not a smart thing for both candidates to appear with Rick Warren, but it's just like so many other things that people do politically. They'd be far better off to go to, 25 individual places than to say, well, where's the one place we can go? Look at the mess McCain is in by saying, okay, John Hagee is that representative person. Well, it turns out that, Hagee's rhetorical record is pretty bizarre. And yes, there's a segment of TBN evangelicalism that thinks John Hagee is all that and a bag of chips. I mean, he ate the bag of chips, but he's all that. And but you're not reaching evangelicals by getting that photo op. And you're not going to reach evangelicals by having Barack Obama appear with Rick Warren. And you're not going to convince evangelicals to get up and vote by having Rick Warren appear with John McCain. Goes back to something that was said about evangelicalism in the Washington Post a long time ago. An ambiguous statement where a Washington Post reporter said that evangelicals are easily led. Well, is he right? Well, there are some evangelicals who are easily led. But there are a lot of evangelicals that aren't paying any attention to the entire process that's trying to lead them. They're being led in terms of leadership on an entirely different level by a whole different crew whose names and agendas the mainstream media and the big-time political powers are hardly even aware of. So I have a constant call. Let's discover all that diversity and quit thinking that we all are Rick Warren. Rick Warren is at best as generic an evangelical as you can find. And you don't find many people who say, I'm a generic evangelical. You just don't. Okay, I'll be back in just a second, and we will get into that last segment of my Cornerstone seminar. Okay, let me cover the bases real quickly. July, first weekend of July, Cornerstone 08 in Bucknell, Illinois. They have 3 days of kind of an open university. It's called Cornerstone Exchange, and they just invite all sorts of people, academics and practitioners and folks from different communities. They bring them in and they say, talk to us about your thing. So my thing was evangelicalism and the experience of being in the evangelical wilderness. And then I did another seminar on transparency and vulnerability. And we'll start a three-part overview, maybe three, maybe more, three-part overview of that in the next podcast. As I said earlier in the podcast, my first segment, which you can get on, 101, was on my experience in the evangelical wilderness. And then, no, it would be 102. And then 103, podcast 103, you can get the critiques of evangelicalism that speak to me out here in the evangelical wilderness. And that would actually, I think, interest some of you, because you might be surprised how much a critique from Louis Boyer, a Roman Catholic writer, affects me. And today I'm going to talk about, okay, what do we do out here? What do we do? What's our responses? If you're in the evangelical wilderness, the great temptation, of course, is to do nothing. It's to be cynical. It's to be selfish. It's a difficult place to be. You know, the great thing about institutionalism is it's like, okay, well, here's something to believe in. I can believe in what the institution's doing. I can believe in the agenda of this institution that I'm a part of. If you separate yourself into your own path, and you're passing by all different versions of evangelicalism or passing through it, it's hard to remain optimistic. It's hard to remain with a sense of this is meaningful, this is going somewhere. And you really risk, and trust me, I know what I'm talking about here, as the guy who has negative things to say about everything and very little positive to say about anything. And that's part of the reason that I am morphing my writing over to Jesus-shaped spirituality at jesusshape.wordpress.com, is that I do not want to simply be a constant critic of evangelicalism. I want to make a positive contribution in this time when traditional evangelicalism is sinking and a new evangelicalism is arising. I think one of the basic problems we have is that evangelicals in the wilderness are not really willing to stop and ask the tough questions of themselves. They're kind of like the stereotype of male drivers. I know I'm lost, but if I just keep wandering around, I'll find the way out, or I'll find the way through. And we don't want to stop and ask questions. And we do need to stop and ask questions. And we need to ask questions of a lot of people. And in fact, the basic response that I want to describe here is one in which we, as we are in the evangelical wilderness, we become students of a broader, deeper, more ancient Christianity, of the larger church, of those whose traditions are deeper than our own and older than our own and different than our own. We learn from them. So response number one is this. In the evangelical wilderness, we need to go back to the sources of evangelicalism and draw from them the resources for our present evangelicalism. And that's a really important step that I think all of us need to embrace. When God spoke to his people in Egypt, he identified himself as the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And God had not been that to this particular group of Israelites in Egypt for 400 plus years. He was reaching back into their roots to say, if you're going to know who you are in the present, in the future, you're going to have to know who you are in the past. And evangelicalism, as Boyer has said, pretty much has a war on it, on its past, on its roots. It believes that with an open Bible and a really bright guy, you can recreate Christianity from scratch. And that's simply not the case. We do have roots, and they're good and they're bad. We did come from someplace, and there's a story to be told. And we need to go back and discover our revivalistic roots, our Puritan roots, our Catholic roots, our Anabaptist roots, our biblical roots, Old and New Testament. At this point, I told a story that I'm not going to retell here in the seminar, because you can go over to JesusShaped.com, and excuse me, JesusShaped@WordPress.com, and you can pull up what is, I think, one of the better things that I've written. And what that is, let me find it here. It was a piece that I wrote about two words on a little red piece of plaster. And you probably know what I'm talking about if you kept up with that blog. But if you don't, it is a little relic that I saw at the Vatican Splendors exhibit in Cleveland. And it is just the words, "Peter is here," that was found under the Vatican, under the altar of St. Peter's, about 60 feet down, underneath all these layers of tradition, all these layers of building. There was found this burial place of someone, and all over it, very simple plaster, and just scratched on that plaster in graffiti were the words, "Peter is here." And I said, if that is the grave of Peter, then there is a guy who responded to Jesus, became a follower, whose whole world was turned upside down, who found himself going someplace that he would never have chosen to go, who found himself living a life that he would never have chosen to lead apart from Jesus. Jesus took his whole life into a new and different direction for the sake of the kingdom of God and for the glory of God in Jesus himself. And I said, we may disagree about all the stuff in the 65 feet and everything that's above that piece of plaster, but we can all go back to that piece of plaster, to the basic call of discipleship, to the basic experience of discipleship. We can all go back and say, that's my Christianity as well. And so in the evangelical wilderness, we need to do that. We need to go back to the sources and say, that's my Christianity as well. Nobody owns the Wesleyan Revival. Nobody owns the Reformation. Nobody owns St. Francis. And on belongs to all of us. And that's my second response, is that we need to mount a St. Francis-style response to the forces shaping evangelicalism. We need to study the life of this guy. Francis was one of the greatest reformers, because his reform was not denominational or institutional. It was one of a Jesus-shaped Christianity. And if you are not a student of St. Francis, let me recommend to you Ian Morgan Cron's book, Chasing Francis, or any number of recent biographies. It's going to be hard to go wrong. Some are better than others. But you need to just get the basic idea of, here's a guy who decided in himself to create the Reformation, to in himself create the Revolution, in himself create the Jesus-shaped Christianity. He didn't go looking for it. He became it. He didn't say, well, there's not a church that I can be part of. No, he became the expression of the church that he wanted to be part of. And I think we need that kind of response. I particularly am impressed that St. Francis gathered around him a kind of spontaneous community, and that he became a person who was able to articulate a Jesus-shaped Christianity to all kinds of people, even those who were far above him in worldly and institutional power and authority. And I really pray that we will have folks raised up who can, from a position of poverty and a position of radical discipleship and a position of commitment to expressions of community that are new, well, not really new, but new in evangelicalism, that those voices will be able to rise up and speak to evangelicalism. And for that reason, I'm praying for people like Shane Claiborne and those who are inspired by him and those who are radically rethinking evangelicalism's economic witness. If there is a coming economic crisis in the West, and I think it's highly likely that there is coming in the next several years a looming major economic crisis, one of the great challenges for the church will be to present a credible witness in economic terms. Simple living, no devotion to money, sharing, helping the poor, living with the poor, embracing poverty, And we need to start that, a St. Francis-style response to the forces shaping evangelicalism. My third response is that we take on, each one of us personally, Thomas Merton's project of combining in ourselves all of the different traditions that have shaped Christianity and particularly evangelicalism. You know, Merton had an experience in his life. It's called the Walnut Street Epiphany. I think you can Google that at internetmonk.com, and I've written about it. A moment where his monasticism was really challenged because he was on the streets of Louisville. I think he was been going to the dentist, and he was suddenly gripped that he was a part of this community, this city, these people walking up and down the sidewalk, and that he was called to be one with them and express Christianity to them. And his monastic calling to withdraw from the world was really challenged by this eye-opening experience of being part of the human family. But he went back to the monastery, and he wrote, and he published, and he mentored, and he combined in himself monasticism and secular discipleship, the world and the church, the voice of Christ, and the voice of human experience. And made it, I think, a much deeper impression than if he would have been just one more, you know, anti-war protester or one more person living in that 60s atmosphere. Take on in yourself the challenge of bringing Catholicism and evangelicalism and the ancient church and the contemporary church and the Wesleyans and the Reformers and the Arminians, the Calvinists and the Pentecostals and the rational. Bring it all together in yourself. Find a place for all of it, for all of it. Ask some questions about exactly what sort of disciple am I, and why am I the kind of disciple that I am. And you may discover that you've been shaped by particular processes and totally unshaped by others. For example, you may not be able to relate at all to what I'm talking about in terms of an economic witness. Is that because it's not there? Is that because Jesus doesn't believe anything or teach anything about money? Or is it because you've only been shaped by what your church taught you about tithing and giving? You see, this is why we need to reach out to other traditions and adopt the position of a student and be taught, because there are more things to shape us than just what has shaped most of us in our churchianity. The fourth response that I would suggest is that we look long and hard at what the culture war is doing to us as evangelicals, and that if we are going to involve ourselves in what we would call the war for our culture, that we look at it in terms of radical Christianity. And I would use, and not conventional politics, I would use the Amish tragedy, the recent Amish tragedy, as an example. Of course, you know that a couple of years ago, a maniac went into an Amish school, murdered a bunch of little girls. The Amish community, in its dignified response, expressed forgiveness and restoration and reconciliation to the family of the murderer, to the murderer himself, shared the funds that had been raised with the family of the murderer, publicly demonstrated Christian forgiveness in a way that stunned the media who covered the story and completely separated the Amish from evangelicals as the media usually covers them. It was like, who are these people? What religion is this? This is obviously not the same thing that we see in American churches. If we're going to say, okay, it's important to shape the culture, influence the culture on issues like homosexuality, on issues like gay marriage, on issues like abortion, we need to learn from people whose response is radically Jesus-shaped, who are prepared to undertake suffering, who are prepared to love those who are different from them. We've got to get off all this anger. We've got to get off all of this blaming, all of this choosing up sides and vilifying the other side. We cannot have a Christianity that's shaped by weirdos like Michael Savage and talk radio hosts more than it's shaped by Jesus and the apostles and the scriptures and Francis and Wesley, and you know what I'm saying? We have to say we do not fight flesh and blood, and we don't use worldly weapons. And what does that mean? Jesus was a culture warrior. He was creating a counterculture community. He was creating a radical counterculture community, a new Israel shaped around the love of God and the gospel. So he deeply impacted culture, but he didn't do it the Constantine way. The final response in my seminar is that we need to ask Jesus to begin and continue turning over the tables in our lives. In the story of Jesus turning over the tables of the money changers in the temple, we need to understand that Jesus is approaching something that was an accepted part of the religion of his time. He is not burning down the temple. He is not saying the temple has to go. He's saying this part of Second Temple Judaism, this commercialization of a place of prayer, this exclusion of the Gentiles, this embracing of a kind of economic abuse and the power of the Sadducee, this is a den of robbers and has to go, and he turns over the tables. Not everything, but the thing that's wrong. And I don't know anything that's more difficult for those of us in the evangelical wilderness than to say we want to hold on to our commitment to the Bible, our commitment to evangelism and missions. We want to hold on to our Protestantism. We want to hold on to all of those things that are distinctive about ourselves as evangelicals. But we want to get rid of the prosperity gospel. We want to get rid of the USA American gospel. We want to get rid of the suburbanization. We want to walk a different path. And Jesus, turn over some tables in our religion. We just have a way of saying, well, you know, the tables are there in the temple courts, so God approves of them just like he approves of everything else. No, those tables had no place. They were an abuse, and they were a painful abuse of everything the temple was pointing to and everything the temple meant. Well, it's been wonderful to have you along today. This has been Internet Monk Radio Podcast number 104. But before we go, let's say where you can find it. You can find it at internetmonk.com, which is my website. You can find it under the Internet Monk Radio tab at the top of the page. You can also find it at iTunes, where we are where I've been the recipient of 15 really nice reviews, and I'd be glad to get 15 more. If any of you want to do that, that keeps us up there at the top of the list. And you could subscribe, as apparently hundreds of people have, to the podcast at iTunes. If you can't find it, just do a search on Monk, go to podcasts, and there I'll be, your one and only Internet Monk. So, this is Michael Spencer, your Internet Monk, saying thank you very much for spending some time with me today. And until next time, I'll see you.